Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you're listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Pullman. Recovery Radio is recorded live at the Latah Recovery Center and elsewhere, located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continuing recovery. And this week, we're going to skip the February calendar because I got a guest I want to get to pretty quickly here. And he's got a great story and a lot of inspiration and hope. And his name is Max. Welcome, Max.
Thanks, Johnny. I'm glad to be here.
And Max, why don't we start out like we usually do with our guests on here and tell us a little bit about your history, where you come from, where you are, and then we'll dive into your what I think is a pretty inspirational story.
Well, I like to joke that Cotton Eye Joe doesn't have anything on me because there's a lot of where I came from and there's a lot of where I went. I was actually born on the East Coast to a relatively poor father who had a relatively strong hold on my emotionally poor mother. And we traveled in a converted mail truck, me, him, my older sister, and my mother across the northern half of the United States. And every time we would stop, my dad would bleed whatever city we'd stopped in dry and we'd move on. We ended up settling in a very remote part of the Montana mountains when I was four or five. But the entirety of my infancy was, besides a short stint in Pennsylvania, where I have pictures of me on one of those really nice red plastic big wheels. We ended up in Montana and things did not get better. My father was not a upright citizen by any stretch of the imagination. He attracted the same kind of people. When I was a baby, his cure for me being upset about teething was to rub a little of nice strong whiskey on my gums. And when I was cranky, he'd put some in a bottle with apple juice and it put me right out. And that was my introduction to the fun and love of alcohol. One not so humorous anecdote. I've never really been into sports. And in fact, until about, I'd say 15 years ago, I couldn't watch a halftime show without getting violently ill for some reason. And I found out it was because my father had a bunch of his friends over for the Super Bowl one year, and they were watching it on that huge 30 or 24 or 36 inch TV that was in the huge wooden box. And I was making too much noise, so he just started feeding me shots until I passed out. So not a real big sports guy, which is kind of odd for a person who lives on the Palouse, considering all the sports ball you guys get into. But back to the history part, you know, from Montana, I ended up leaving my own home at a young age after my parents divorced because of abuse. And I ended up running pretty hard for most of my young, even before I was a teenager to my teenagerness. I got to spend a lot of quality time in really neat installations that were put there for the rehabilitation of young men who were caught doing things they shouldn't be doing. And my mother, God bless her soul, decided she'd go into psychology so she could figure out what was wrong with everybody she knew. So there was not a lot of love from the abusive dad respect, and there was even less for the analytical mother. And so I stayed on my own for most of my life. There are certain things that happen when you're a boy and you're charismatic and you've got a sense of humor that lead to interactions and altercations that also lead to children. I'm pretty sure those of you who know how that works out know exactly what I'm talking about. And so with the birth of my first child at 16, I thought I should probably go straight because his mom was not. And I spent 8 months of my life trying my damnedest to raise a baby and work full time while living in what would have been my in-laws if we'd been married basement, so they could watch the baby when I was passed out because I had to work. After that 8 months, some shenanigans ensued. The mother came back into our lives and had made some claims that meant that I would not be able to raise my son. And because of my past legal history in those great juvenile detention centers, the state decided after several months of stringing me along that I wasn't allowed within a certain number of yards of my own son. And then I didn't care about staying sober. It was the weirdest thing. There were a few more kids along the way before I had an intervention. And each one of those kids either drove me worse or better. I have a 23-year-old daughter. She'll be 23 this year. That is my sobriety chip from drugs. Because when I found out she was on the way, I decided that I wanted to try and make this whole white picket, leave it to Bleaver, 2.3 kids, 4.5 cars, whatever lifestyle, a thing. So I quit doing a bunch of drugs and started drinking a little bit more because drinking's legal. It didn't work out so great. I ended up having some of those past transgressions catch up to me. Ended up spending about 4 months down in a Stoughton County jail for a felony assault that had happened years before this, but it was enough to scare me into trying to find more profitable work that was legal. I left Montana, where I had been raising my daughter, and left her with her mom and went to Colorado and worked in the oil field for almost a decade and made way too much money and developed a pretty good bottle a day habit of the go juice, but I couldn't do it at work. So I just, when I got off, I went either straight to the bar, or the girlfriend that I had gotten that we were getting kind of serious, she got to stay at home and take care of my and make sure there was a drink on the table when I got home. Needless to say, life didn't get better just because I had money. It only took a few years for me to completely ruin almost everything that I had going for me in my life except for my job, but the environmentalists did that for me. So I ended up being on one of the last rigs that was working down in my area until I fell asleep at the wheel and rolled the company truck at 70 miles an hour. And the new satellite stuff they had in the truck told them I was going 70 miles an hour. So that was my fault, and I lost my last oil field job. And at that point, I had hit bottom hard enough that I wanted to die. And I had found all sorts of neat ways to try and do that. None of them worked. It sucked. It was horrible. I had to keep being here. I had to keep surviving. I had to keep waking up in my own skin and hating everything I was, everything I had been, and everything I thought I could be. I hit bottom pretty hard, and I made the mistake of shaving my mohawk, which was the same haircut I'd had since I was an itty-bitty kitty running around the city. One of my friends in Spokane saw that and started calling me every night asking if I was ready to come home, because she knew what was up, even if I didn't. And so it took several days of that. And I was too drunk to remember the night that she tells me she called, and I told her that if she could beat me to the punch, I'd come back. I don't remember that phone call because I was drinking probably about a half gallon a day at that point because I wasn't at work, so I didn't have to be sober. And that's just what I drank at home. That didn't count how much I drank at the bar so I could eat a meal because I wasn't cooking. I cashed out most of my 401ks so I didn't have to worry about bills for a little bit. And proceeded to set about trying to kill myself with alcohol. One Friday night, I'd sat down with four bottles in front of me, a couple of bottles of whiskey, a bottle of vodka, and a bottle of pills. I'm deathly allergic to vodka. Two shots, I pass out, stop breathing. So my plan was to start with the whiskey and work my way to the end of the table and try and finish as much of all the things that were on the table as I could before I passed out and died. There was a boom, boom, boom on the door, and this woman from Spokane walked in with her boyfriend and scooped up all my and told me that I had two choices. I could help her pack my stuff, or they could pack me first, but I was going back to Washington and they were going to get me into treatment. So yeah, that's how I got back to the area of the Palouse. They tried putting me in a dry house in Clarkston, but there's bars in Clarkston that have pool tables. And if there's a pool table, I drank for free. So that didn't work out. So the next obvious solution was to put me in the middle of a wheat field in Steptoe friggin' Washington and tell me, find a pool table here. And I couldn't. So I ended up getting sober. I ended up going through a 28-day treatment program. I wasn't sober after that. I ended up getting involved in a 12-step program. I didn't get sober after that. I got sober when the lady at the treatment place that had my Washington State ADOTSA program suspended 2-year sentence hanging over my head pointed out that I had not signed the piece of paperwork that said I would not drink or do drugs. And I said, well, you know, when I got here, I needed to drink so the DTs didn't kill me. And she goes, do you still have to do that? And I was like, no. And she goes, well, if you don't sign this, I'm telling your probation officer. And even when I was a piece of crap, I kept my word when I put my name on paper. So God screwed me out of that one. And I ended up having to figure out how to live life on life's terms and not want to die. And that's how I met Johnny. Oh, wait.
Almost. Very close. Very close to those times.
But yeah, that's how I got to the Palouse. I've been in this area for coming up on 12 years or 13 years. It'll be 13 years in February of this year. I decided to stay here because of the support community I have here and of the fact that two of my older kids live in Spokane and one of my older kids lives in Clarkston. So I am close to a lot of my kids physically, emotionally. I've actually managed to rebuild relationships with 5 of the 6 children I have. And that 6th one, when they're ready to talk to me, I will answer any questions they have and I will try and mend that relationship. But until that point, the best thing I can do is just keep messaging them every couple of weeks and tell them I love them until they choose to respond to me.
Great. Well, that's a history. Exciting, adventurous. You know, I had not heard the part of your story about how young you were when you left the abusive home life, but it's not an unfamiliar story. You know, I've heard it quite a bit. Seems like we alcoholics can strike out on our own at any point with the honest belief that we can make it somehow.
Well, and you know, I left out a lot of details to protect the guilty.
Right, of course.
There was a point where I got lucky and stole the wrong stereo, and the guy was admiring the fact I had that kind of guts. He didn't use those words. And I ended up doing jobs for him, breaking and entering and doing other stuff for a while before I moved on to chemical entrepreneurship, which was the main way I made money until I went legal for that first kid. And when they told me that wasn't good enough, I went right back to it. So for people like us, and I've seen this in almost every person I've seen in recovery, the people that really, really glomp onto this thing, it's because they were really, really brilliant and they weren't smart enough to not get outsmarted by a liquid. Right. So
yeah, I totally get that. And yeah, you know, I've often heard it said by people who have done some serious time, you know, if I'd have devoted as much energy as I did to doing crime to, you know, doing some sort of gainful employment type thing, I'd be doing pretty good without the felony record.
My mother, when I made amends to her, I ended up going out to her place, and I was working construction when I first started working in this area. And she asked me to come out there to build her a barn. And I went out there, and the first night she was like, you know, I always told my friends at school, because she went to college and got her PhD in counseling. I always told my friends at school that you were either going to be a person who changed the world, or you were going to be the best drug dealer anybody had ever seen. And you did the second one. Can we work on the first one now?
Yeah.
Pretty. My sister's actually a cop because she found out that I was dispensing products to her friends in high school.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean...
Well, you've been inspirational to a lot of people, evidently, more than I thought.
Yeah, that's what we'll go with. And yeah, she is actually a very successful cop. The one thing she never succeeded at was catching me. But she's also the person who picked me up when I got out of treatment in Spokane, so she could take me out to dinner and just tell me how thankful she was I hadn't died from my own shenanigans.
Right.
Because she was privy to a lot of information that I won't share in public.
Right.
About the things I was up to and the stuff that was going on. Mm-hmm. And she was just so happy that I wasn't dead. She wanted to make sure that I knew I was loved. I had no clue.
Wow. So we've come up to the point where you've gone through treatment. You've been forced to pen your name to a piece of paper, swearing to, abide by the rules as they were stated. I've hardly found that sufficient enough for most people I know in recovery to actually pursue recovery.
Mm.
So what really happened, Max?
So that happened May 27th of 2010. I had had my intervention in February of 2010. I'd been kicking around the rooms, and I had seen a bunch of people lying about how happy they could be because they were sober. And I believe that to my core, that y'all were a bunch of liars. I was trying to figure out how the heck you could be happy with life as miserable as it was. And, it was probably September when I found out that I had my sixth child. I hadn't known the woman was pregnant. She had left me right before I really spiraled off the rails. And because I had never had a real childhood, taking care of kids and making sure that they can be kids is a major thing for me. And even though me and the mothers of my children didn't always get along, I always tried to make sure that the kids knew I was there. I thought I did, in my own selfish way. And so when I found out that I had a whole nother baby that I hadn't been able to be there for, I freaked the hell out. And there were people that were in the area that had known me from my past that were like, hey man, do you need us to bring you a bottle? And I was like, no man, I can't keep doing that. I gotta figure something out. Because I was dry enough to start a fire. Because, yeah, I put my name to paper. And so I had been gutting all this pain and misery and history and all the pain I'd caused other people. I'd just been gutting it until I realized that you guys might be lying, but if you were, it was sure a hell of a lot better lie than I was living. And so I went to that same woman's house who came all the way to Colorado with a U-Haul. And I stayed with her for a couple of days, and she took me to a bunch of meetings. They were just like the meetings I'd had down here on the Palouse, except for there were less farmers. So I was more comfortable, you know, because I've never been the country bumpkin type. I grew up so far out in the wilderness when I was a kid that we had CBs instead of phones. And the carpool was still an hour to school, you know. So I was addicted to chain link and asphalt, and being in the Palouse was the best thing for me because the farmers and I actually had a lot in common, you know, product, legal teams, I mean, we could understand each other, and in the rooms doubly so, because they knew that misery that I was experiencing and they knew that I could get through it, but I was going to have to do a few simple suggestions. And so they started showing me how to live that, how to do that on a daily basis. I got a couple of men in my life that I really, really look up to because of the amazing way that they live in the face of what they deal with on a day-to-day basis. And so I started doing that. And my life flipped a U-ey. I ended up getting into college. I ended up getting my master's degree before my third year sober. I was running and gunning. I thought I was doing all the right stuff because life was easy. I mean, it had its problems. I had a girlfriend that was a person from my history that had come back into my life after sobriety. And she was one of the first women I ever fell in love with when I was a teenager. So I thought it was God telling me that this is what I needed to do, that this was everything coming together. That was not the case. But thankfully, when that glass castle came crashing to the ground, I had built a good enough support foundation in this area that I could not, I didn't fall off the wagon. I did shut down. About 5 years into sobriety, I started having neurological issues. It just kept spiraling. I was suffering stroke-like attacks. I couldn't remember things. I was having problems working with my hands. Yeah, it spiraled out of control, and we didn't have a diagnosis. And I got to a spot where I might have been sober, but I was back to being dry again. And the only thing that kept me from going out and getting drunk to try and alleviate the pain was I didn't want to have to go back into the recovery rooms and ask for a white chip. So, you know, there's a part in the 12 steps of different programs that's this part where we ask our higher power to remove all the defects of character we have that are not of use to him and our fellows. And, my ego was a defect I still had because it was going to save my life. Because when I got diagnosed with functional neurological disorder, which is a blanket term for a bunch of conditions that doctors can't figure out why there's such a bad short circuit in the brain, if I had drank, there's a good possibility a firing of those old synapses would have short-circuited my whole brain and I would be dead. But I got to a very, very dark place. And my significant other, my weaponized happiness against the world, who will remain nameless, but if you know, you know, she got so scared, she asked me to call my sponsor in the program that I'm in. I called him and I alternated between crying and screaming at him for about 45 minutes before he made this wild accusation and said, well, what aren't you doing now that you were doing before? And so I started doing that again. I started being there for my fellows. I started trying to be of service to others instead of wallowing in my own. And once again, my higher power granted me a miracle. My ex-wife and I had been estranged for several years. She got a check when I got on disability because of this condition that made her freak out because it was a sizable check. And she hadn't heard from me, and it was the state. So I received a message in short order. Oh, my God, are you okay? What is going on? Did any of the rest of your kids get this benefit? Which then put me in touch with another one of my kids that I had never met, which then allowed her and I to build a relationship that I love today. She calls me Dad. And that's a big thing for a guy who wasn't there for the first 15 years of your life, you know. I'm blessed that four of my six kids call me Dad in one form or another. My youngest boy calls me Max because he has a dad. My ex-wife's new husband stepped up and filled that role, and I'll never be able to thank him enough for being there for my son. But he has earned the title Dad. For me, that's the difference. And I'm not mad at him for it because of the things I learned in the rooms that we're talking about right now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It was quite the trip to get back to being okay in my own skin, but it was that discomfort. That discomfort is what it takes for me to change, because I'm a thick-skulled person, and I have never met anyone too dumb to get the programs that save us. but I've met a lot of really smart people. Oh, they struggle with this stuff, man. And it's one of those things where I have to get beaten down enough that I'm teachable, that I'm willing to do it somebody else's way, because my way might have worked for a little while, but it does not today.
And I really appreciate you bringing up the events that kind of drove you back in hard. A couple of things. One, I've heard that to make a knife with a good sharp edge that works, it has to be heated and pounded and heated and pounded again. And that's kind of what life does to us, you know. And hopefully if you get to be, you know, around my, you know, 6 or 7 decades, you finally got an edge on that knife and you're able to deal with things a little better. But quite honestly, if it hadn't been for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my blade would still be dull and soft and I wouldn't be able to, try to accomplish the things that I'm doing now. Yeah, I remember back, Max, or, you know, when you were on early in, you would show up to a meeting with a car literally full of guys that were either trying to get sober or thinking about getting sober. And I always remember when you talk about service work, you say, and if you don't want to do any service work, talk to your sponsor and then come back and talk to me. And, you know, it was a constant reoccurring message. And, you know, it was, for me, it was inspirational. And I looked at you and I said, hey, this guy's working it like it needs to be worked, you know, hard and straightforward and no BS.
Well, and that's one of the things that I've found has served me both in and out of sobriety. In every job I ever had, whether it was legal or illegal, I'm not there to make friends. I'm there for what I need. And this is not a selfish program. Not a single 12-step program is a selfish program. But before I figured that out, I had to be awful selfish. I had to be selfish with my time. I had to be selfish with my emotions. I had to be selfish with me, because I needed to have it locked in before those storms were coming. And that's the thing, is that service work is such a major thing. If you were involved with somebody, and even if you're not in the 12-step program yourself, and you see them trying to do something and they need your help, just because they're too proud to ask, get in there and help them. You know, there's a lot of responsibility here that a lot of people forget about. Is I only have the quality of life I have today because I was a selfish prick. Okay. I had to be selfish in order to get beat up enough to be willing to learn this stuff.
Right.
Okay. I had to be so selfish. I didn't want kids in my life, even though I didn't know how I could live without them. I had to be so selfish that my needs came first in every single facet of existence, even though that damn near killed every relationship in my life, friend, family, foe, whatever. I had to be that person so I could get here. I have no illusions about the fact that I was a monster back then. And if I was a monster back then and I can use those same powers for the forces of good today, guess what? Hand me the cape. Okay. And that's what service work is. That's getting out there and getting in front of it. And when somebody looks like they're struggling, you get in there and you help them. It doesn't matter if it's with your group or with your house or with your neighbors, you do what you can. And you do it for fun and for free, and you don't ask for anything in return except for the fact that it gives you that warm, fuzzy feeling in your chest. That's what it's about.
Right, right. And you'll see memes all over the internet that say, you know, do something nice for somebody and don't tell anyone and see how it makes you feel. Yeah, you're right. It does give you that warm, fuzzy. And, you know, I find for myself now where I used to get a whole lot of joy about personal joy, you know, seeing somebody get sober and stay sober that I've helped and worked with them. And now when I see that, the warm fuzzy I get is when I say thank you to my higher power for helping that person and for helping me say evidently what needed to be said when it needed to be said. You know, that warm, fuzzy feeling has more become an indication to me that I need to keep doing this and more and more.
So, and for somebody who's lived their entire life in the storm, and that's how I view life. Life is this cyclone of activity, you know, and it's got everything that I see or that I want to see just swirling around in this cyclone. And when I move in the path that my higher power wants me moving on, I stay right in the center of that eye of that storm, and I'm safe and I'm protected and it's calm. And as long as I keep moving the way I'm supposed to be moving, I'm right there the whole time. But anytime I try and reach into that maelstrom for some little bit of what I think I need or what I want, or what I need to change in this person or this situation, I get sucked up in that storm and I get spun around until I'm smart enough to let go.
Right.
And that's what it had to be for me. I had to get that lesson, because when I got disabled, I went from being a guy that liked working, you know, 40 to 60 hours a week, to being somebody who I thought I was going to be watching Oprah the rest of my life. And that was not going to make me happy.
nor the people around you, I venture to say.
But that's the thing, is that with the tools that recovery has given me, once I finally got out of my stuff and started working the same program again that I was working when I was passionate, that passion came right back. That's the thing they don't tell you all the time in the rooms. We hear all about how addiction is progressive, but you don't hear about how recovery is too. I've seen so many guys that, like, they do this in and out and in and out and in and out, and they still have the amount of recovery they've managed to pick up. And if you look, even when they were out, that recovery was bothering them because it was growing, because they were gaining experience. You know, and the trick is hopefully they make it back before that experience is killing them.
Right.
Because then it becomes our experience to carry on that, man, I miss this guy. You know, man, I was there when he went to his first meeting, and I was there when he collected his 6-month chip, and now I'm at his funeral. The stuff that recovery is the only way we get through that stuff. Because back in the day, if I had a friend OD, we'd have a party for him. How messed up is that?
Yeah, been there. Yeah. it's a twisted way of looking at life, you know. It really is. And I get that. I mean, I've been there. I've done that. You talk about recovery doesn't happen on, you know, a linear growth pattern. It's for me, it's very, very digital, very binary. Either I'm moving forward or I'm moving backwards.
Yeah.
I don't get to rest on my laurels and say, well, I'll pick this back up next week, you know, because I won't be where I was at today. I'll be where I was at today minus a week, and then I got to recapture that week, and then I got and it's a pain in the tuchus. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Disease, like they say, you know, your disease is a 500-pound gorilla sitting in the corner doing push-ups, just waiting for you to think, yeah, I got this figured out.
You know, and I heard that all the time when I first got to recovery. You know, my alcoholism, my addiction's out in the alley doing push-ups. Mine doesn't have to. Mine's sitting in a bell tower somewhere with a 3.75-liter bullet locked into that barrel. And if I come out not wearing the spiritual armor you guys gave me, he's going to take my friggin' head off. Okay. Yeah. That's because I know my personality. I'm going to be like, yeah, I can handle doing it like I used to do it. And my brain is going to go, yeah, watch this stroke, you know?
Yeah.
We can't. But that's realistic. That's, I mean, it sounds funny.
Right.
But it's realistic because I know me. I want to be that guy sometimes. I want to be that monster, because that monster didn't have to feel all these things, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's, For me, the probably the heaviest part of my addiction was, you know, after my mother passed away, and I did not want to feel that that grief. I absolutely did not, and I worked really hard to make sure that any sort of feeling of sadness got drowned in a, you know, big drink of whiskey of some sort.
So one of the issues I have due to this neurological condition is when I sleep for more than an hour, it wipes the entirety of the time I was awake. Like I like to call it my etch-a-sketch. Like I've drawn this really nice picture while I've been awake. And if I go to sleep, somebody comes by and shakes it a couple times. So there might be little bits and pieces I catch, but the whole picture is pretty much gone. Okay. So at 2:50, an hour after I got up from my nap, when my alarm went off that said I was doing a radio show, and I told my significant other, my weaponized happiness against the world, my external hard drive, but she remembers all the things. And when I told her, oh, apparently I got an interview, she went, since when? So like I was pretty sure I knew who it was I was going to be talking to, because I'm talking to other people about the thing in my text messages that I was reading while I was waking up. You know, I have all sorts of tools that help me remember certain bits and pieces.
Right.
But until that alarm went off, I had no clue. She had no clue. But it's that whole, if I don't do this stuff, if I don't keep making sure people know that it doesn't matter how messed up things get, you can have a miracle in your life that gives you a quality of life you don't have to get away from. Okay. Right.
Or that you That's can't get job. Away from.
Okay. Today, yeah, I don't go to work anymore, man. I'm stuck at the house. Oh, darn. I have a significant other who's also working a program. She gets paid to take care of me. Okay. I get paid because of that legal work I did in the oil field. I made so much damn money that they figure it's easier to pay me to stay at home than if I get in the car, forget where I am, and run into a family of six.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'd vote for that.
Okay. So, and this is the thing, is today I get to wrap silver linings around clouds.
Right.
I get to see where those things are that mean that I can keep doing this. Okay. My first sign is when I wake up. If I wake up, I know that I've got a purpose, because if I didn't, I wouldn't wake up. So now my job is to find out that purpose. Well, I can't find out that purpose if I just stay in my head. Well, I don't have anything in my head to stay in anymore. God's done me a great favor.
Yeah. You want to talk about living in the moment. You ain't got a chance.
Well, and we joke all the time that, you know, if I'm stressed out, I should just go take a nap, because when I wake up, I won't remember what I was stressed out about.
There you go. There you go.
But on the opposite side of that, that means if I do something messed up, I got to make amends for that now.
Right.
I got to fix that.
That's right. You have instantaneous tenth step.
Okay. Because the worst thing that's ever going to happen is I'm not going to do that. And I'm going to go to sleep and I'm going to bump into that person at a meeting and I'm going to think everything's fine.
Right.
And that's not cool. That's me stepping on their feelers. I don't want to step on other people's feelers. Because I know what it's like to have feelers that hurt when people friggin' step on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it says in the book, you know, we step on people's toes and they get sore. I mean, who knew? The reality is, in life, you're going to step on people's feelings without even realizing it. But once it's known to you, for a normal person or, you know, a normal temperate drinker or whatever you want to call those aliens out there that we have to deal with, you know, they would go and make an apology for that. For us, we have to go through a process of, you know, understanding what our part was and trying to, you know, make things right. And without I waited around and waited around trying to think my way out of situations like that. And all it's ever done is made the thing worse.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have a drinking problem today. I have a thinking problem today. Yeah, I haven't had a drinking problem in a long damn time. Okay. My problem is all in between my ears. And yes. I mean, nothing is more true than looking at my life and going, yeah, there's not a single thing in my life a drink and a drug wouldn't make worse. Not yep. one, you know? And that's the thing, is that when it comes down to brass tacks, I'm more worried about the person that I don't want to have to make amends to than I care to admit. I mean, because that's what stops me a lot of times from saying what's on my mind.
Sure.
Because I'm going to have to make amends to this person if I say this.
And you know? I hate making amends.
I hate making amends.
I hate pulling back that sheet and looking at myself and going, oh man, you did it again. Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to for me today is I'd like to say there's some holier than thou, you know, everything's perfect thing going on with me. There's not. I know that I'm still just as capable of being a spiteful, mean jerk. Okay. Yeah. I am completely aware that that is part of my makeup, not a small part even. So without the program to stop me from being like, yo, this is what you don't know about you that you should know for the rest of us, that doesn't come out of my mouth anymore.
Right. Right. I quite often give myself the 3-question test. Does this need to be said? Does this need to be said by me? And does this need to be said by me right now? See, usually I might get as far as the 2nd question.
Nice, necessary, and true.
Yep.
If it doesn't fit all 3, it probably shouldn't come out of my mouth. And I still fail at that. I still have to make up for when I tell the dog that it needs to get its kibble and get the hell out, you know?
Yeah. Well, as I understand it from my Christian friend, there was only one guy that was perfect and they nailed his to a tree. So, yeah. Maybe that's a bad thing to inspire to be. I'll just keep being human and until I get my wings, you know.
Well, and I'm not even worried about that, okay? And that's another thing that people have to understand about me and my sobriety, okay?
Yeah.
I talk a lot about loving God, and I talk about loving my faith and my higher power, and my beliefs are that when I get up there, it doesn't matter what I think I know, I'm going to be wrong, okay? Mm-hmm. So when I speak of God, I know it's hard to tell because my mouth doesn't, you can't see my mouth. It's making the lowercase G shape. I believe God is a job title, not a name. If I'm ever cool enough to think I understand even a portion of the infinite, I'm messing up. So I try not to put no labels on it. I say he a lot because that's the vernacular, but I don't know if it's a gender or if it's a tentacle. I mean, I've seen Japanime that does weird stuff, so I don't know. I'm pretty sure that if I live my life happy, joyous, and free as an example to others to how to be happy, joyous, and free, and I do my best to be of service to my fellow man and a worker among workers, then I don't have to have a 9-to-5.
Right.
Because I've got it every day. I've got it every hour. I've got it whether I remember having it or not. It's here.
And you know what? I think that's a great note to end on, Max. And hey, again, you know, it's been my honor to have you as a friend and a fellow for these many years. And hopefully that'll keep going for a while. And I think I'll shut this down with the usual, which is, you know, if you think you have a problem with alcohol or other drugs or behavioral health, you do.